Welcome to Money Maze Curated Podcasts. We created this spin-off channel to highlight a selection of innovative firms in the finance sector and beyond. If you visit www.moneymazepodcast.com, you can also sign up to our newsletter to keep up to date with episode releases and access a range of resources and materials relevant to each guest. If you enjoy this episode, please follow this channel and leave a review. Thank you for listening. In an investing world where passive shades of grey have increasingly eclipsed earlier decades of a large rainbow of active managers, it's good to unearth a global asset manager aiming for active, high-conviction, listed equity and high-yield credit strategies. So Stan Moss, CEO of Poland Capital, welcome to this curated edition of the Money Maze podcast.
Oh, thank you, Simon. Happy to be here today with you.
I hope we're going to get a really nice picture of your business and what's been developing and your thoughts for the world ahead, as well as some of the strategic opportunities as the asset management continues to evolve quite sharply. But maybe we could just sort of, set the scene for you, Stan, and just give us a little insight into some of those early, educational decisions and how that started to point you towards finance.
Yeah, I grew up in a really small town in the United States, in a state called Alabama. Both my parents were educators and grew up on a small farm. And I also played sports. So I played football, baseball, and basketball, and was fortunate enough to be able to play football in college. So I went to the University of Alabama, and there I received an accounting degree, and I also received an MBA from the University of Alabama. And this led me into my first job, which is with Coopers & Lybrand, which is now PricewaterhouseCoopers. And then later in life, I got a master's degree.
Okay, so let's go back to your trajectory. You're there working for Coopers & Lybrand, you're trained accountant, and then how does financial services come knocking?
Yes, I was very fortunate when I was at Coopers & Lybrand to have the opportunity to see a variety of different industries, everything from education, healthcare, manufacturing, and financial services. And when I had the opportunity to work on the financial services companies, I really felt engaged that that was something that I would be passionate about and wanted to explore and learn more. And an opportunity came up with a local bank that recruited me over to work on a technology planning and implementation group to deploy technology all across each area of the bank holding company, the consumer bank, the commercial bank, and the wealth and asset management side. So when I was assigned to the wealth and asset management side of the technology and planning group, the CEO of the wealth and asset management group identified me as a young talent and then placed me into a role to be the CFO of the entire group. So that was really my initial foray into wealth and asset management. And through that, I learned a tremendous amount. We were doing over $250 million in revenue, had over 1,000 employees. And part of the story that led me to Poland Capital was that we were able to go and lift out three different investment teams and startup investment management firms. So that was my first exposure, and it really excited me. I got the bug. I was passionate about it. So from that point on, I was looking for opportunities out in the industry where I felt that I could leave and go make a difference. And when I saw the opportunity at Poland Capital, I was able to jump on it.
And what were you brought in to do?
So the original founder of the firm, David Poland, he brought me in to run all aspects of the business outside of security selection and portfolio management. So the firm was less than $1 billion and less than 10 people in total employees when he brought me in. So I came in as a big fish in a little shop. So I was COO, CFO, and CCO. So when the due diligence people would come in, they'd ask to speak to different people. I would just turn around and say, it's me again.
So go out of the room and come back in.
come back in. Yep.
So now give us the snapshot of Poland today. Mission, size, offices.
Yes, quite a different firm today. We're over $50 billion in client assets. We have over 200 employees, and those employees are working in one of our offices. And our office locations are Boca Raton, Florida, Boston, Massachusetts, London, England, Abu Dhabi, and Hong Kong.
We're going to talk a little bit in a minute about building an asset management business, you know, organically and through acquisition. But what I noted as I did my research and talked to some of your colleagues is that there appears to be something described as a Poland person, which was a very specific way of describing the culture that seems quite strong. And I wonder whether you could just sort of talk a little bit initially about what might be the characteristics of that person.
One thing I would note there is, you know, I've been at the firm for a very long time, and culture is extremely important to us as an organization. So from time to time, people will say, how do you maintain the culture at your organization? And I always say, look, I'm not trying to maintain it. I'm actually trying to improve it, to adapt and change to the current circumstances and improve it. So this Poland person concept actually came up after years and years of us working on culture and us saying, like, what are the key characteristics of people that we had identified at Poland Capital that we'd want to be able to work here? And those are, you know, we start with a person who's really tied into the purpose in the organization. Like, they want to do great things for our clients, great things for the community, and great things for their teammates. So purpose is a big part of it. Accountability, like, we need people who hold themselves accountable, who hold other people accountable. The third one's emotional intelligence. So we do a lot of work around growth mindset, emotional intelligence, just being better human beings, being better people, being better colleagues. So that's a key criteria. Lifelong learning, which I already had talked about. And so, you know, taking that, and I always want to be an avid learner and continuing to learn and grow as a person. That's a key characteristics. The last one I'll mention is the one I think is probably the most important in the entire industry, because the industry ebbs and flows. You go through cycles, things happen. So the last one is grit. So we want people who come in who have grit, to have that resilience to work through the tough times and just keep going.
That sort of certainly resonates with me. And we're going to talk a little bit about your organic versus the inorganic growth. But before we get there, you know, investment industries continue to evolve. We all know the explosion of passive, hence my comment about sort of the color gray that sort of characterizes a lot of the industry. From where you sit, what might be the really powerful secular forces you think are at work?
Yes, there's a couple that are at work right now. And there's a large transition from traditional asset management into alternative asset classes. So you see asset allocation models allocating a higher proportion of client assets to alternatives. So this has created quite a wave in growth for all alternative asset managers. And then, you know, within that, a subset of that is, like, how do you get those alternative investments, because they tend to be more illiquid, in the hands of the wealth channel? So there's been vehicles created to package these products to enable them to be delivered to wealthy individuals, where historically they've primarily been distributed and used by institutional clientele.
And you're straddling the public and private domains, and we'll come back to that. But as I went through your history, I was struck by a few things. You recently acquired a team from Aberdeen. You also bought Somerset Capital's business, which for those in the UK will be very familiar because of Rees-Mogg's association with that. And I wondered what's on your shopping list, as in, do you have a set of strategic objectives or silos that you're wishing to fill, or are you in some cases simply opportunistic because something comes up and you're in a position to act?
Yeah, we always look at things from an opportunistic perspective, but we do have a clear strategic objective within our firm to grow the amount of assets that are in credit or in alternative credit at our firm. So when we're able to find teams or acquisitions that can add to the total body of work that we have here with regard to Poland credit, is something that we're interested in and looking for. And then the Aberdeen team led by Ben Peckingham is a perfect example of that. We were able to lift out one of the best European high yield managers in the marketplace and global high yield managers to join Poland Capital. So we're really excited to have Ben joining our team. He actually just joined this month. So we're excited about the potential there.
And we know this is a human business with all of the frailties and vulnerabilities that come with that. People walk in the door. As you said, the team's just left Aberdeen. How do you weigh up if you like, the pricing of those acquisitions, because it's not easy.
Yeah, the way we think about it, whether we're acquiring a firm or lifting out a team to join our firm, is we really look at the strategies that they're offering, and do those strategies have a tremendous value proposition for a client? In other words, are they high value added? Do they look very different from the competition and very different from the index? So we really start there. So that's our aim, is to have these highly differentiated products to offer our clientele. Then you say, well, are these people a very strong cultural fit within our organization? Do they meet the characteristics of the Poland person? Would they be favorable and adapt to autonomy, mastery, and purpose within our culture? And if the answer is yes, then you can find teams and M&A opportunities where you can bring those individuals into the organization, because they are seeking what we have to offer here as a platform at Poland Capital. And that greatly increases the probability of long-term client outcomes being positive, and through retention of those people, because they're rejecting wherever it is or their current situation and opting in for the situation that we're presenting here at Poland Capital. So if we live up to the value proposition or our promise to those individuals, they'll be here for very long careers.
You've been doing this, you know, for a while, which is intriguing, because only in the last 5 months has the sort of the omnipotence of the US equity market been challenged after a very long period where we know what's happened to, you know, to capital flows. So your, if you like, your senses appear to have been thinking about a world investing order that would shift, which would be, you know, understandable in historic terms, and also given the valuation of the US. I'm making you sound very strategic, but tell me a little bit about how you think of that global opportunity map.
Yes, that's very important to us strategically. So if you go back to the early days here at Poland Capital, 100% of our clientele were based in the United States. So we have a strategic initiative and strategic effort to extend globally. And we put a lot of things in place, as I mentioned, with our offices and clientele that we've developed. So in the European and Middle East region, in EMEA, we've been able to garner quite a bit of client assets. And then in APAC, we've also been able to gain client assets. But those in total are about 15% of the total client assets that we manage at Poland Capital. And we would like to get that something much higher, say in the 20 to 30% of our total asset base. So we're putting a lot of time, effort, and energy into introducing Poland Capital, introducing our investment professionals and the highly talented people that we have in market closer to the clients, to hopefully build that client base up over time.
Have you sensed your ultimate investors are starting to think about a reorientation away from the US, both because of valuation, also because of the dollar's potential vulnerability and the lack of their own asset allocation to those other areas?
Yeah, we've seen a couple of shifts. You know, the first, with interest rates increasing in 2022, we saw a big shift where people were moving away from equities and into credit products. Today, with what's happening in the U.S. markets, emerging markets are producing double-digit returns year-to-date, and they haven't done so in quite some time. So I think there's renewed interest in emerging markets, and clients are starting to ask more questions that they haven't asked in probably the better part of a decade.
Yeah, and I think the number, give or take, hasn't moved that much, is that, you know, at the end of last year, the emerging market index was at a 50-year low relative to the S&P 500. And as we know, this is a business where mean reversion or the stretching of the elastics tend to be, you know, recurring themes. I know you are not managing money today, there you are managing the business, but could you talk a little bit about, in your materials, you describe the investment approach as being rooted in quality, and that can mean a lot of things to different people. But if you are synthesizing the credit and equity approaches and that as a sort of a very important underpinning, what does that mean to you and your colleagues?
Yes, the term quality is something we primarily refer to within our equity business. And we've been investing in high-quality companies for more than 35 years, since 1989. And the key characteristics around those companies are they tend to have a competitive moat around them. So they're highly resistant to competition. They produce tremendous amounts of free cash flow. They have very low levels of debt and then double-digit earnings per share growth rates. All this leads to returns on equity of greater than 20% or returns on total capital greater than 15%. So these are markers of a high-quality company across the board. And when you run those basic metrics, there's actually not that many companies on the globe that actually would qualify as one of the companies that we would actually research and consider for a portfolio. So we believe that by investing in these competition-resistant companies that produce this cash flow and earnings per share growth rates over time, if that's going to lead to double-digit returns, hopefully mid-teens type returns over very long periods of time, and that will inherently, we believe, outperform a given benchmark or the competition.
And I think I'm right in saying in your, for example, your growth equity, your portfolio consists of 20 to 30 names. So properly concentrated, you know, there's a lot of people who talk about getting alpha and then run what I might argue are closet index, you know, portfolios. But that level of concentration brings with it, you know, more volatility, particularly relative to the benchmark. Again, you have to have that sort of almost seared into the culture. So for your equity business, how do you keep people, you know, on track when the headwinds of underperformance, which come for various periods always, you know, arrive?
Yes, your concentration comment is very interesting because most people would assume by running a concentrated portfolio that you would have higher levels of volatility. And what we've seen from our portfolio over decades of experience is that we actually have less volatility than our peer groups and most of the time against the index as well. So why is that? So when you get down to pure number of names in a portfolio, once you get to around 20 names in a portfolio, adding the 21st name or the 22nd name, the amount of volatility decrease you get from that is de minimis. So by investing only in the highest quality companies in a concentrated fashion, that actually dampens volatility over time.
Just staying with that, because we know there are lots of great companies in the US that are outside of, you know, the Magnificent Seven, et cetera, and are large companies, even if they aren't sort of, you know, mega by US market cap standards. Are your managers finding the same quality in various other parts of the world that they're very excited about?
Yes, in other parts of the world, certainly. And one thing that's great about this moment in time is that you can find very high quality companies outside the United States that are likely trading at a lower valuation than their peers in the United States. So we think there's a tremendous opportunity to invest in high quality companies that meet the characteristics that I described earlier at a cheaper valuation.
Well, I'm with you there. Let's move to the private credit world, because I said it's interesting that you have the public equities and then you have the private credit. I just take a step back. I think that some people, maybe perhaps it reflects on sort of the older generation of investors, are surprised at the huge growth in private credit. And I think we understand it to be a little bit of banks having to rein back and the disintermediation of other players. So let's talk about the credit, by which I mean sort of the lending, the debt part of your business. How do you think about that and where you want it to evolve?
You know, we have over 25 years of experience in credit, and we have a tremendous credit engine, meaning from an operational perspective and from a deep fundamental research perspective on credit research, just fantastic people, experience, and longevity there. The main strategy that's been run by that team over a very long period of time has been an opportunistic high-yield strategy. And within that strategy, we have bonds, we have loans, and then we've had a basket for direct lending within that. So when we look at what we could do today and what we are doing today with credit is we can, of course, manage opportunistic high yield or multi-asset credit within that format that we've been managing for over 25 years. Or if a client would like a particular sleeve of that, so if a client wants a bespoke loan fund, we can do that for a client. If they would like dedicated
lower middle market direct lending. We can carve out and have a pool of assets that's just managing that private credit or lower middle market direct lending pool. And then within the loan area, one of the things that we found very, very attractive and are extremely excited about is we took our skill set as analysts and investors in loans and then built upon that to launch a CLO equity offering. So that's structured credit with loan portfolios. We brought in one of the top portfolio managers in the industry for CLOs, Rick Richard. And Rick is, he's managed over 30 different CLOs. He's been CLO manager of the year several times, and he joined Poling Capital. And we actually have our first CLO up and running, and we're raising capital for subsequent CLOs. So we're extremely excited about that one because that is a natural extension of what we purchased when we purchased DDGA Capital and brought in Dave Brizzano and his team.
So just for those who may be listening to this podcast who are less familiar with collateralized loan obligations, just give us the skinny on, you know, what they are doing and what the, and how they fit into client portfolios.
Yeah, I mean, our guys talk about it in terms of being a better bank. So, you know, we're borrowing at one rate and then we're lending out at another rate. And then there's a spread and then you lever that spread. So, you know, if we can, if the differential between our borrowing and lending rate is 1500 basis points, then we're able to lever that. We can get up to a 15% annualized return for our clients. It's a cash on cash return of 3-4% per quarter. So it's, you get liquidity off of it, and it's a fantastic option with limited levels of volatility and a good return stream for clients that are seeking income.
Okay. And one of the lines in your materials that struck me, and I just got to quote it here, is we view credit risk as different to the agencies. And I'd love you to unpick that.
Sure. That's something that's fundamental to Dave Brizzano. We call Dave Brizzano the OG or the original gangster of credit. He's been in the business for quite some time now. And Dave will just say, look, he goes, not every company's created the same. So, but that credit rating agency may view them in the same way. So let's take, for example, if you have a company that has debt that's 6x EBITDA. You have another company that's trading, this debt is 6x EBITDA as well. So they look the same to the credit agency and they'll give a similar rating to those two. However, it could be two completely different businesses and the market value of one company could be 15x EBITDA and the other one could still be 6 or 7x EBITDA. So which one would be the better business and have a lower chance of default or risk? Of course, it's going to be the one that's trading at a higher valuation. So we see those two things differently, and that's how we view it, where the credit agency is really just looking at the terms of debt.
And when you're fishing in the pond and you own triple Cs, now for many people who aren't, you know, dedicated debt investors, that would be, they would think sort of, you know, junk, etc. I think you have a slightly different view on that, and that's something to do with size as well, isn't it?
Yeah, it has something to do with size, but it also ties into directly what I was saying. So that credit agency on that business I was talking about, this is six or seven times debt, it's going to be rated triple C for sure. Our team may come in and say, you know what, it's a triple C, but not all triple Cs are created equal. All right. So we would say that's a higher quality company within the triple C space that we believe has a yield premium on it that we can invest in and get a superior return for our investors. Also, the smaller type companies, if you're talking, you know, $25 million to $50 million in EBITDA, you know, the credit agencies may have a propensity to have those as lower rating. It could be a fantastic business with lower levels of debt that we see differently as well.
To what extent are the banks not playing in this space in the way they used to?
Yeah, from a regulation perspective, I think banks are more hesitant to lend. But what we see is that, you know, there's a duration mismatch at the banks. The banks are taking in deposits, and on any given day, a consumer can come in and ask for those deposits. And then on the other side, the bank is lending out at longer rates. So you have that duration mismatch, which has caused some problems for a few banks here in the United States. So we're not looking to participate in that game. We're looking to invest in over the long term with higher yield and great credit quality for our investors.
And I noted again that there was this theme mirrored in the equity portfolios, which is that it is said in your materials that concentrated portfolios have a yield advantage. And I wonder again how you think about diversification, which you explained very well in the equity context, in the credit context.
It's similar in the credit context, but instead of being 20 or 30 securities, you're looking at 70 to 90, so quite a bit more. But in credit, having 70 to 90 different securities, that is quite concentrated. So we're doing deep fundamental credit analysis on each of those issues and securities. And what we're doing is constructing portfolios that have a structural yield advantage over the index itself, think 200 to 400 basis points. We expect defaults, even though we have a hefty weighting in triple C's, to be in line with an applicable index. And because we have skilled attorneys on staff and have covenant heavy documents, we expect our recovery rate to be more than two times that of the index, and have done that for over two decades now. So when you think about the value proposition, you're getting a yield premium, your default rates are in line with the index, but you're recovering much more than index, and that's producing long-term alpha for our investors.
So when we had a call last week to for me to understand your business a little better, I asked you a question and I thought about it afterwards. It was interesting. I asked you the question then about to what extent your debt and equity teams cooperate, collaborate, which happens in a lot of entities who manage those pools of capital. And you made the point quite straightforwardly that in fact your equities, those companies don't carry a lot of debt. So in fact maybe the crossover isn't as valuable. But where would you like to see your colleagues managing debt and equity discuss and share ideas?
Yeah, honestly, there's not that much overlap there, but some of the securities that we invest in from an equity perspective do have debt. So we have debt experts within the firm. So to the extent our equity companies do have debt, we can, of course, ask our colleagues on the credit side, what their thoughts are about the debt that these companies have on the balance sheets. But frankly, on the equity side, most of the time, these companies, if they were rated, if they did have debt, it would be AAA rated debt. So in our credit business, we're looking at, below investment grade debt across the board.
I got it. Now, the other strand of your business is that you actually manage equity and credit ETFs. And I wonder just how that business has, developed and how you think it might look in a few years' time as investor behavior changes.
That's a big change in the U.S. The mutual fund business has been in somewhat of a secular decline. So each year there's been persistent outflows, particularly in active mutual fund flows. And if you look at ETFs, not just passive, but on the active ETF side, you're seeing persistent inflows into active ETFs. So in the U.S., there's a tax advantage to holding ETFs. The ETFs are much more efficient from a trading perspective. You can trade them all day, every day. And they tend to be also more efficient from a cost perspective. So because of these things, allocators are now choosing to allocate to active ETFs over mutual funds. So if you're an investment manager like ourselves and you say, well, we're going to choose to do the same old, not adapt to change, that's not going to be a recipe for long-term success. So we need to be able to provide the vehicles that are in demand by clients and in demand by the industry to be able to meet that need. So we can run our same investment strategies within just a different wrapper of an ETF. And if that's what the clients wants, that's what we're going to deliver.
Okay, well, Stan, that's clear. Thank you. So I've got slightly wider questions. Is that, the investment management business can be really tough when the wind is in your face. And we had an episode of that, around the tariff imposition a few months back. And portfolio management can be a lonely job when the wind is in your face, and your portfolio managers might collectively, or at least severally, be feeling the strain. How do you think about managing morale and, helping the culture at those points of stress?
Yes, there's always points of stress. We've gone through different cycles. I say one thing that's unique about this particular cycle is there's a lot of people in the industry who haven't experienced downturns. They went through COVID, but other than that, COVID came back really quickly. So this point in time could be the first time that they've really experienced a challenge in their careers. So some of the people who've been around a bit longer can show support to those individuals, talk about how things looked in the past, how you got through it, just offer, lending ear and support throughout. But I'll also say that, you know, there's always going to be tough times. So one of my favorite quotes is from Winston Churchill. Winston Churchill says, if you're going through hell, keep going. Don't stop. Now keep going and you'll get through the other side. So as long as you're grounded in your fundamentals, your investment process, your investment philosophy, you're executing that at a high level, you're going to get through it over time because what you're doing is sound. So if you stick to it and you keep going, you'll come out the other side.
Well, I'll add a second Churchillian quotation, which I refer to because we can be quite short-term in this industry. And he once said, the further back you look, the further ahead you can see. And that, of course, is important when one goes through those traumas and, you know, and thinks the world might be ending. A different question, which touches on that earlier point about culture, is that as you grow your business, acquire different people in different geographies, that cultural cohesion is more difficult. What are the one or two things that you really want to do to keep that culture, cohesive?
This is a particular question that we've actually thought about a lot, done a tremendous amount of work on, and we're always trying to adapt. And what we found is no matter where the person's located, across the globe, if they work in an office or they're a remote employee, that there's really three philosophical tenets that when we're hiring, we talk about them and that these people can adhere to, and it permeates throughout the globe. And those three things are autonomy, mastery, and purpose. So when we talk about autonomy here, we're really talking about freedom. And of course, with any level of freedom, you have to have frameworks around it. So think about an investment process, but we give our investment people the time, space, and resources they need to research companies, interact with those companies, and manage portfolios in the way they see fit to drive outcomes for clients. We also don't require people on a day-to-day basis to come into the office for any period of time. What we're doing is saying, like, we need you to focus on delivering a work product, delivering for our clients, delivering for all the stakeholders. And if you choose to do that from Starbucks or your living room or the office, we're less inclined to force anything there. So that's a lot of freedom within a framework. So that really hits on autonomy. The second one is around mastery. And we talked a lot about this earlier with the Poland person and some of my background, but this is really gets to lifelong learning. So as an organization, we want avid learners to come into the company and just have a deep desire to continue to learn to get better. So from my perspective as a leader, I always say that from the time a person joins our organization to the time they leave our organization, for whatever reason that may be, I want them to be exponentially better than the day that they join. And that's a goal of ours. So we support that with intention and resources, time and money to help them develop. So that can be in the form of bringing in guest speakers, buying books for people, supporting education, you name it. And we give each person in the company a stipend of $5,000 to use at their discretion to learn as how they see fit. So that really drives that. So you have freedom and then you have learning, which are two key components. And then the last thing is really the most important. And that gets back into the Poland person that we're looking for. This desire for purpose and connectivity. So we want every single person to have a deep connection with what is it we're trying to do here. We're actually trying to provide financial security and peace of mind to our clients. So we're trying to improve the lives of our clients themselves. So if you can come into work here and you're not just thinking about spreadsheets or whatever, or making pitch books or whatever it may be, you're actually thinking, we're actually here to help a client and improve that client's life. You're tying into a deeper purpose. Another thing that we do, and we across all the different offices and all people here at Poland Capital, is we give a lot back to the community. And just to tie in how we make this resonate. So on both the community side and on the client side, we'll have an opportunity to bring in clients to the firm and have the clients sit in front of us. So think about having an audience of all the Poland Capital people, and then on a panel, you have firemen, policemen, could be a doctor, a nurse, or teacher, they're sitting up there and they're telling us why we actually do what we do and how that impacts them, you know, how important it is for them on a day-to-day basis as the client that we deliver a value proposition to them. The second thing is around the community, we'll do the same. So I'm on the national board of the Make-A-Wish Foundation, and they'll give us the opportunity to have a wish child and their family come into the organization. And then we'll have a wish revealed or granted to that child so you can see the direct impact that we're having on the community. And the last component I'll mention on that is just to further bring it home. We put pictures of both our impact in the community and our impact on clients on the walls in each of our office. We call it our why wall. So in other words, why we do what we do on a day-to-day basis. So everyone can come in and see, like, those are the clients that we're working for. This is why we're here on a day-to-day basis. And then here's the children in the community that we're helping across the globe. So that's the purpose part. So if you say, you know, it's a long answer, but we're back to the autonomy, which is the freedom, the mastery and learning, and then really connecting to this purpose. And I always say that if a person's listening to me out there and they dig what I'm saying, they come to Poland Capital.
So Stan, let me move to some closing questions. I'd just like to start off with looking forward the next, let's call it 5+ years. How would you encapsulate, you know, the vision for Poland Capital?
Yes, we talked about this a little bit before, but everything that we're doing at Poland Capital is we're trying to produce high value outcomes for our clients. So we're not trying to look anything like an index. We only offer highly differentiated strategies, and we're expecting differentiated returns for our clients. So when you look at Poland Capital, we built this fantastic platform of operations, technology, compliance, distribution across the globe. And then within that, we have these highly differentiated investment boutiques plugged into it. I mean, think about a watchmaker like Patek Philippe and like the craftsmanship that's required to make that watch. So we apply that same type of discipline into the selection of our investment teams and then having those unique boutiques plugged into the platform that we've created. So when you look across our large cap team, our small cap team, emerging markets, our credit team, we think this is a collection of masters. And that is what we're trying to deliver for our client over the next 5 years and 5 years plus. And anyone that's added into this would fit in that same mold.
Well, Stan, I've enjoyed finding out about, you know, Poland Capital and your, you know, terrific growth. And I would say, knowing the asset management reasonably well, pretty differentiated, you know, approach at a number of levels. And if I was summing up, I think you probably spent more time talking about culture than many of your peers might do. And that's possibly because you spent a lot of time thinking about it. But I like that the subset of that cultural perspective is the ingredient that you really want to see is grit, because we all know that, you know, you're going to need it when the headwinds happened, however and whenever, because they sure as hell will come along. That in the equity offerings, the hallmark is of concentration, but of high quality, and you define quality, you know, very clearly. And that in credit, there is this opportunity that you feel that your approach and your team has been able to capitalize upon because of size and the way that the agencies have sort of, you know, evolved. And having lived through Olympia and York and various other things where the credit agencies were terribly assured of high quality only to see this business disappear, I'm probably a bit more cynical, than some about those, those entities. So thank you, Stan, for spending the time, you know, with us today on the Money Maze podcast.
Oh, thank you for having me, Simon. It's been a pleasure.
All content on the Money Maze podcast is for your general information and use only and is not intended to address your particular requirements. In particular, the content does not constitute any form of advice, recommendation, representation, endorsement, or arrangement, and is not intended to be relied upon by users in making or refraining from making any specific investment or other decisions. We try to provide content that is true and accurate as of the date of publishing. However, we give no assurance or warranty regarding the accuracy, timeliness, or applicability of any of the content. Guests, presenters, and other individuals involved in the production of this podcast may have positions in any of the investments discussed.